Some argue that a fast-growing world population will further exacerbate the adverse impacts of climate change. But is population growth really the main culprit that explains continued poverty and increased environmental problems? And are governments reluctant to talk about birth control? In this episode, I discuss whether population control is really the elephant in the room, as some claim it to be.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
Much of Africa is experiencing high birth rates, which according to The Economist magazine is one of the main culprits for the continent's pervasive poverty. Having spent a considerable amount of time in Malawi over the past decade and a half, and Malawi is one of the poorest countries on the African continent, I'm very familiar with the growing concerns among my Malawian colleagues of their country's fast-growing population, currently estimated at 18 million and counting. My colleagues are worried about the impact this high growth in population will have on the delivery of social services. Malawi is poor, they say. There simply isn't enough resources to cater to this many people. But Malawi is hardly alone. Consider the case of Tanzania, which has an estimated fertility rate of 4.9. The country's president, Mr. John Magufuli, does not apparently see the point with birth control. He announced in 2016 that women could throw away their contraceptives as state schools will be free. And in September 2019, Mr. Magufuli also claimed that birth control was a sign of parents being lazy, and that a major consequence of widespread contraception is a shrinking labor force, which in turn is bad for development. Other recent reports, including one from the Gates Foundation, have claimed that certain countries in Africa, such as the Democratic Republic of Congo and Nigeria, are projected to witness massive increases in their populations in the next few decades. And such an explosive growth in population will in turn pose major challenges for government policies aimed at promoting development and the well-being of citizens. But it is not just Africa. The two Asian giants, China and India, have both struggled in the recent past with the population problem, although with varying degrees of success. China has for long had a one-child policy. This was in place between 1980 and 2016. And aimed at preventing a population boom. Some of the tactics in China involved forced sterilizations and sex-selective abortions. Thus, demographers have for many decades been worried that the impact of this very invasive policy on human lives would be immense. One real concern was the severe gender imbalance that this one-child policy has caused. Consider the fact that millions of men will not be able to find female partners in China. There are simply not enough women around. The official Chinese narrative, however, claims that this one-child policy actually averted over 400 million births. This policy, or at least this narrative from the Chinese, also claims that the one-child policy helped propel the country's impressive poverty reduction within just a few decades, in addition to aiding the global environmental agenda. Now, although these numbers are largely disputed by demographers, there's general consensus around the world that coercion-based policy of population control, including forced abortions, is not the desired alternative for other nations to follow. And in recent years, the Chinese government began relaxing its one-child policy for certain groups. For example, since 2013, family planning laws have been amended to allow minority ethnic families and rural couples whose firstborn was a girl to have more than one child. And in 2015, the Chinese government declared that it will, and I quote, fully implement a policy of allowing each couple to have two children as an active response to an aging population, end quote. Indeed, Chinese policymakers are trying now to encourage a baby boom, but the jury is still out. And the evidence thus far is that many couples, given the growing expenses related to having additional children, have not opted for the second child. Now also consider the case of India, which is projected to become the most populous country in the world in the next 6 or 7 years. Like China, India too has a checkered history of family planning. Indeed, most social commentators now argue that India's experience has been less than optimal. In particular, the numerous instances of forced sterilization and other abuses that characterized population control policies for several years in the late 1970s have been widely criticized as classic instances of a state trampling on the democratic rights of its citizens. Indeed, the government of India carried out very public and aggressive sterilization campaigns in the 70s, in the 80s, although this did not appear to gain much support from the population. So for many decades, India's had one of the highest rates of female sterilizations. And between 2011 and 2012, government figures show that around 4.6 million women were sterilized. But male sterilization rates are low and viewed as culturally unacceptable by many. Thus, only a small fraction of Indian males have had vasectomies. Like China, India also has a major problem of gender imbalance. For long, there's been this kind of preference for the boy child, and selective abortion of girls has been a feature in some communities. The fact that population is a problem for a country like India is, of course, not necessarily disputed. And the COVID crisis in recent months has shown how difficult it is for governments to enforce mass quarantines and lockdowns in congested, overcrowded cities. And India has many such cities. There are, of course, also numerous conflicts over land and water rights, and all of these combined with inadequate infrastructure and weak welfare services is creating social tensions in many parts of the country. And as India is now poised to become the world's most populous country soon, talk of birth control in the Indian public discourse appears muted. The country is also reportedly unprepared for this dubious honor of becoming the world's most populous country. In his book, Principle of Population, the English cleric and scholar Thomas Malthus claimed in 1798 that social happiness would greatly diminish if the world's population continued to increase unless this growth was checked radically. The argument was that population growth will outstrip food production and, given the limited amount of land and resources available in our world, disaster is imminent unless fertility rates are made to decline. Now, given the increased visibility that the climate change agenda has achieved in recent years, it has become far more acceptable now to openly and perhaps also often uncritically subscribe to what has been termed as neo-Malthusian fears of the negative impacts on nature that can result from unchecked growth of the human population. So some claim that famines and starvation-related deaths are nature's solution to an impending crisis. But would controlling or slowing down population growth really help the negative impacts of climate change in the future? It turns out that answering this question has become actually quite difficult. And what we have seen in recent years is a very polarized discourse. One set of arguments claims that there's enough scientific evidence to indicate that adding 4 billion more people to our planet by the year 2100 would exacerbate the adverse impacts of climate change. In a fascinating article in Science magazine from August 2018, John Bongartz and Brian O'Neill refute several so-called misperceptions related to population growth, population policies, and the relationship between population and climate change. They argue that despite its adverse impacts on the climate, the population question is largely neglected by the climate community, including the influential Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Bongartz and O'Neill argue that the population problem has been exacerbated due to a fall in AIDS mortality, followed by consistently high birth rates, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. And the UN predicts that the world's population will reach almost 11.2 billion in 2100, with sub-Saharan Africa expected to grow from 1 billion, which was the case in 2015, to 4 billion in 2100. But not all agree that controlling birth rates is the solution to improving the world's climate. For example, some argue that the concerns about unrestricted population growth are especially irrelevant in certain countries, in certain low-growth countries like the United States. Some others argue that even at the global level, overpopulation is an overstated problem. Still others point to the success stories of the Green Revolution in strengthening the world's growing capacity to feed its population. And thereby they try to debunk the doomsday claim of Neo-Malthusians and others who claim that population growth is really the problem that is threatening our very survival. And I'll discuss some of these issues slightly later in this episode. Another strand of thinking believes that modern technology, including solar and wind power, will greatly, in the near future, reduce the impact of overpopulation on global warming. And still others, like President Magufuli of Tanzania, believe that having a lot of young people, and thereby a large labor force, is actually pretty good for developing countries. So the discourse is indeed extremely polarized. And although many governments and civil society organizations every now and then talk about the importance of controlling birth rates, population control policies do not currently appear to enjoy much political interest. Is this then a problem? And if so, what should we be talking about? I believe one reason for a reluctance to address the population question is the numerous development successes the world has witnessed in recent decades. Most governments and organizations are in the business of saving lives from HIV, from malaria, from hunger, from conflict. Indeed, international agencies and most political and societal actors talk about the importance of living long lives with good education, better nutrition, and good healthcare. These are essential parts of the concept of human development as promoted by very well-known economists like Professor Amartya Sen and Dr. Maqbul ul-Haq. And even many academics sometimes find it difficult to be persuaded by the science on the environmental footprint of population growth. This is because a large part of what we think we know about population control strategies is influenced by the coercion and abuses that characterize sterilization campaigns in India and forced abortions in China. Even when research within the various fields of the natural sciences provides credible and even compelling evidence and projections of the link between population growth and climate change, convincing policymakers to do the so-called right thing may be fraught with numerous difficulties. Not all evidence on the projected increases in world population appears convincing. And many projections, including those of the United Nations, are characterized by large doses of uncertainty. So one group of researchers has recently concluded that whether lowering population growth entails ensuring overall improvements in human well-being rather than merely cost savings actually depends on the kind of ethical approach that we adopt in valuing human lives, in valuing the whole population issue. So societal goals matter and shape political priorities on birth control. Politicians, it turns out, are also reluctant to jeopardize their re-election prospects and may not feel comfortable in trying to at least do their best to antagonize voters by talking about the population issue. There are cultural, religious, financial, political reasons for not wanting to speak more forcefully about birth control or the use of contraceptives. Family planning policies may also be poorly planned and executed, lack of resources, it could be weak targeting mechanisms, there could be inadequate participation of the community. Often family planning policies are characterized by poor communication of risks and benefits. Sometimes these policies also fail to address problems related to social stigma. So these may perhaps at least partly explain why population is not explicitly mentioned in the 2030 agenda and the 17 so-called sustainable development goals that world leaders adopted in 2015. Another set of arguments points to the futility of talking about population control. Rather, they argue, a lot of people, including some of my colleagues, that we should be talking about the importance of better protecting reproductive rights, improved access to contraceptives, strengthening efforts at promoting gender equality, improving education, especially for girls, and in general, increasing the living standards of the world's poorest people. Thus, according to my colleague Arve Hansen, and I quote, "If we are able to make development sustainable, we should rather be dealing with questions of distribution of resources and with the consumption patterns of the rich," end quote. So Arve argues that the consumption patterns, particularly in rich parts of the world, in rich countries, require closer scrutiny. And these consumption patterns include things like meat consumption, highly polluting forms of transportation, electricity generated from fossil fuels, or just the fact that we love shopping for and owning new things all the time. I mean, we do love buying stuff that we don't really need. Another set of issues in the population control discourse relates to ethical perspectives. From a developing country perspective, from a low-income country perspective, any talk of population control has indeed numerous ethical implications. For example, much of the discourse can be, in some parts of the world, interpreted as the rich world telling the poor not to have too many children. And so people living in poverty are left wondering, what really is the problem? They feel that given their low consumption lifestyles, they actually contribute very little to increased emissions and pollution levels. Those who consume a lot typically tend to actually have fewer children. However, as my colleague Arve Hansen again puts it, and I quote, "The few who consume a lot are worse for global sustainability than the many who consume little," end quote. So many in the global south are therefore very suspicious that the population problem, as is exemplified in the international discourse, is perhaps overstated to justify restrictive immigration policies in the West. Or that it is a way of telling poor countries that they cannot expect to continue receiving generous amounts of foreign aid or other forms of assistance. And such concerns do indeed appear to be valid. Let me illustrate this by referring to a debate that took place in the 1970s when various parts of the world were experiencing severe food shortages. And famines began taking place in certain parts of the world, be it Bangladesh or Ethiopia or Sudan. Many neo-Malthusians and so-called ecologically oriented ethicists began warning of a population explosion which would cause increased problems for all in the future. A very influential book was published in 1968 called The Population Bomb by the American biologist Paul Ehrlich. And he argued, and I quote, in the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now, end quote. He was basically saying that population control was the most important policies that many countries around the world could undertake. An influential voice in this debate, particularly in the 1970s, was Garrett Hardin, who popularized the concept of lifeboat ethics. So what is lifeboat ethics? Well, this idea of lifeboat ethics advances three basic propositions. First, there is not enough food in the world to match the world's population growth. Second, the source of the problem of food scarcity is the unrestricted population growth in poor countries, which are often vulnerable to famine and require constant external assistance. And third, rich nations have ownership rights to the food they produce, and as such, there is no moral requirement for rich countries to share their food with those starving elsewhere in the world. So the idea, according to the lifeboat ethics argument, is that rich countries have limited seats in their lifeboat and cannot and should not help save others drowning in the sea. Because if everyone tries to get into that one lifeboat, it will sink. So the basic premise for Garrett Hardin is that there are limits to economic growth, especially in relation to food and energy shortage in the world. Hardin also argued that basically all nations have a specific so-called carrying capacity. What is carrying capacity? Well, it is the maximum number of people that a nation can support within its territory without risking its capacity to feed its population. And according to this view of carrying capacity, many nations have already exceeded or threatened to exceed their carrying capacity because their birth rates have increased and their death rates have decreased, resulting in a population explosion. Under such circumstances, Garrett Hardin claims that giving food aid to famine-hit countries will amount to interfering with the outcome of starvation. Such action will accordingly only serve to reduce the death rate and eventually increase the birth rate because those saved from starvation deaths will later procreate. So Garrett Hardin cites the Indian food crisis of the 1970s and concludes basically that food aid is morally wrong since it worsens for those who survive and for future generations the food availability situation and the overall quality of life. So he asks, and I quote, "Will our good intentions be sufficient excuse for the consequences of our actions?" End quote. As to be expected, such views have been very, very controversial. Some have described the lifeboat ethics argument as a clear case of advanced muddlement. Since if there's one conclusion that we all tend to agree, at least among informed persons of our time, it is the idea that we are not in separate boats, but we are all in the same boat. And philosophers such as Peter Singer have argued that rather than not helping people dying from starvation and famine, we should be doing as much as possible to help people in need, even though they may be strangers. And there's a whole body of work in philosophy about displaying solidarity with strangers. So population control, some argue, is only a part of the problem of world justice. The real problem, they argue, is rooted in the relationships between nations as well as on the individual relationships within nations. But Hardin also had his fair share of supporters who have sought to modify his approach by stipulating certain conditions under which the right to refuse food aid or any form of aid can be justified. The late British inventor James Lovelock argued in 2009 that human activity has started a chain of events that has had adverse effects on the way in which the Earth functions, and that this process is irreversible. This chain of events, according to Lovelock, began from the time humans began using fire and tools on purpose. And things only worsened with the onset of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. So Lovelock here, in his book from 2019, claims basically that the explosive growth in human population on Earth is only disruptive. He therefore supports the Malthusian warning of fatal consequences such rapid increase in population will have on the Earth as well as on human well-being. And this includes the growing frequency of famines resulting from a shortage of food. I've been discussing several arguments for and against controlling birth rates. Given increased global awareness of the seriousness of climate change, of climate disruption, as some would put it, many voices have characterized continued population growths in many parts of the world as the so-called elephant in the room, an issue that few are willing to discuss openly, frankly, honestly, and with the real intention of doing something about it. But others believe that there is really no problem, that by talking about the population issue, we are basically blaming others rather than pointing fingers at ourselves. And my understanding is that almost everyone agrees, or at least appears to agree, that uncontrolled population growth will have implications in relation to climate change in the near future. But the fact is that there are disagreements related to assigning responsibility, who should be blamed, and the type of solutions that are available to policymakers. Should it be a problem that only poor countries ought to address? And is birth control the only solution? How about working towards improving gender equality and the reproductive rights of women? How about improving education, making it more inclusive? And what are richer parts of the world doing to reduce their own environmental footprint by reducing their own consumption patterns? These, I believe, are important questions to be addressed. But I also think we should be highlighting the numerous policies and several initiatives that do not always get much attention, but are nonetheless actually working in trying to change human behavior without resorting to force, violence, or coercion. One success story in recent years has been that of Future Fab, a lifestyle brand created by non-profit organizations in Kenya aimed at addressing teenage pregnancy. Future Fab introduces the idea of using contraception in a way that is able to combat the stigma of using contraceptives. The brand, therefore, focuses on hosting events such as dance contests, fashion shows, and basically tries to facilitate a discussion among young women on their dreams for the future. And while many do not wish to talk about contraception, most women, in this case, in Kenya, among the participants of these contests, shows, events, are indeed more interested to talk about the goals and dreams that they have. So such initiatives like Future Fab are important because they get young people to reflect on how becoming pregnant at a very early age can result in deferring, postponing future plans and dreams, making it even more difficult for them to escape from the clutches of poverty and other forms of deprivation. I've discussed the numerous agreements, but also the numerous disagreements on the population question. There's one thing that most people now agree to, and that is the following. Persuasion, not coercion, is the way forward. If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. I hope you will join me in the next episode when I will discuss why public transportation services remain underprioritized in many parts of the world.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.